Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. As some of you may know, I used to be a Democrat. I was certainly not a raging leftist or even politically active. For most of my adult life, I had no real interest in politics. My interests were always in, let's call it the arts, literature, music, cultural stuff. I was always caught up in cultural or intellectual pursuits and had only a general awareness of what went on in the political arena. I was what many conservatives might call a brain-dead liberal, in that I lived unquestioningly and incuriously in a tightly circumscribed bubble of liberal friends and co-workers, first in the San Francisco Bay Area and later in the Hollywood / Los Angeles area. I literally did not know any conservatives, that I knew of anyway, and I held a sort of stereotyped view of conservatives that was not as harsh as today's left-wing murderous hatred, but I nonetheless held myself in pretty smug and superior regard by comparison to the political right. But I did consider myself a classical liberal until I underwent a gradual awakening and education about political realities, and I found myself moving in conservative circles in Hollywood, surprisingly enough, and began to realize that not only were conservatives not the knuckle-dragging bigots that Democrats relentlessly painted them as, but that the party I thought I belonged to had become, while I wasn't paying attention, far more radical than I was comfortable with. I began to realize that conservatives were the classical liberals, and the Democrat Party had fallen under the control of totalitarian extremists pushing increasingly insane anti-American agendas. This launched my conversion to conservatism, and I began to educate myself, as I said, and to get to know more and more prominent conservative figures, such as the man who ultimately became my boss here at the Freedom Center, David Horowitz, a man who himself famously flipped from radical red diaper baby to pretty hardcore conservative pugilist. Turns out quite a few hardcore conservative pugilists, like another mentor of mine, Andrew Breitbart, began on the left and wised up at some point and made that courageous journey to the other side of the political fence. That conversion almost always runs from left to right, by the way, and there's a reason for that. It's because young people are prone to utopian idealism until they get mugged by reality. But very rarely does it happen in reverse. Anyway, as I said, I began to educate myself about politics. And you know what they say, you might not care about politics, but politics cares about you. And the sooner you figure that out, the better. But in retrospect, I think I devoted more attention to understanding the radical left than I did to understanding the history and theory of my own newfound political beliefs. One result of this was that I knew precious little about a man named Frank S. Meyer, an American philosopher and political activist born in 1909, died in 1972, a man who I recently learned had a seminal influence on conservative icons whose names are much more familiar, people like William F. Buckley, Russell Kirk, Barry Goldwater, and so on. I learned about Meyer through a brand new biography by a writer whose work I was already familiar with. Indeed, he has been a Front Page Mag contributor, a book with the intriguing title, The Man Who Invented Conservatism. And as luck would have it, I have that author on my podcast today, and we're going to dive deep into his biography of the fascinating figure, Frank Meyer. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation, and don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already, so that you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we are having here. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is a senior editor of The American Spectator and a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's the author of 7 books, including A Conservative History of the American Left, Cult City, about Jim Jones and Harvey Milk. I actually interviewed him about that one for Front Page Mag a few years ago. Why the Left Hates America, which I've also read and recommend, and now a fascinating new book called The Man Who Invented Conservatism, The Unlikely Life of Frank S. Meyer. Daniel Flynn, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad to have you on because I think this is an important book for conservatives or for anyone who wants to know more about conservatism or who is interested in political history, but I confess that I knew next to nothing about Frank Meyer prior to reading this book. I recall reading or hearing his name here and there, but only as a sort of a marginal figure in the orbit around much more well-known conservative icons like William F. Buckley or Russell Kirk. But you make the case that Meyer is, as the title reads, the man who invented conservatism. Is it just me, or are most conservatives in the dark about this seminal figure in American political thought? Who was Frank Meyer?
Well, I think you're correct. I mean, when Meyer was on with Mike Wallace in 1961, when he interviewed him, he said, you know, I'd venture to guess not one in a thousand of my viewers would know who you are, but I'm told that William F. Buckley hangs on all your editorial advice and that Barry Goldwater solicits you for political advice. And I think Wallace was, you know, wasn't being insulting. He was correct. And now here we are over 60 years later, and I think probably fewer people know who Frank Meyer is. And that presents an opportunity for a biographer, because there's so many people out there, you know, so many biographies about Hitler or Churchill or Franklin Roosevelt or Abraham Lincoln. We know all there is to know about those people. I would rather write about a guy who should have a biography, who should have a comprehensive biography, but doesn't. And that's what I did here with Frank Meyer.
And tell us about the origins of this book and how you uncovered a treasure trove of documents that were a real revelation about Meyer.
Yeah, and that's part of the reason why people don't know who Meyer is. There's two reasons. One, I found in British intelligence, transcribed conversation between two communists in 1949. Meyer, who had been a leader in the Communist Party, was then testifying in the Smith Act trial in the United States, sending 11 of his former comrades to prison. And these British communists were talking, and MI5 was taking notes, and they were saying, what are you going to do about the history? Did you hear about Frank? And they said, yes, I heard about Frank. I can't believe this, blah, blah, blah. What are you going to do about the history? Well, I'm already rewriting our history. I'm already rewriting the history of the students' movement. The reason they were doing that is because Frank really was the Johnny Appleseed of the communist student movement in Great Britain. He was a major figure over there, and they totally erased him from their history. Conservatives erased Frank by neglect. I found Frank's papers in a warehouse in Altoona, Pennsylvania, after 2 years of searching, and I am quite positive that they would have ended up in a landfill or an incinerator. And, you know, what I found is really shocking. There's, you know, thousands of letters from people like Bill Buckley and Wilmore Kendall and Brent Bazell, who, you know, sort of the founding fathers of the conservative movement, post-war conservative movement. And then you have people like Joan Didion and Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and Henry Kissinger. There's all sorts of material that would have never have seen the light of day if not for this book. So I think when people, you know, particularly conservatives, if they want to do sort of a genealogy of their outlook, this is a good book to start, because there's all this information that has never been seen before, and it gives you a sense of why Frank, you know, is this is what long overdue for this guy to have a biography.
Yeah. And as you already noted, Meyer started out as a fervent communist, just like the Freedom Center's late founder, David Horowitz, before becoming a conservative icon. What sparked that dramatic shift for Meyer?
Well, I think it was rebellion against his parents. I mean, his mother was heavily involved in Jewish causes, and his father was a capitalist. And so he rebelled against his childhood religion. He rebelled against his father's, his occupation, essentially. He started something at Oxford called the October Club. When Frank Meyer got to Oxford, there was zero communists in the student body. When he left, there were over 300. And in that time, he became, you know, sort of, like I said, he was the Johnny Appleseed of the communist movement in England. And you had spy agencies following him. You had them taking notes, which is very helpful for a biographer. They did a black bag job on his apartment. They, you know, put a mail cover on his correspondence. They knew which girls he was dating. They knew what banks he was, you know, what he did his banking at. They knew what tweed jackets he was wearing. What they didn't note in the 160 pages of surveillance of him is that at the very time Frank Meyer was calling for the violent overthrow of the government of Ramsay MacDonald, the Prime Minister of England, he was dating Ramsay MacDonald's youngest daughter. I have a letter from her in this collection where she says, listen, Frank, come on over to my to 10 Downing. You know, my dad is not around. The coast is clear. We'll have dinner. And so Frank was doing something very reckless. I mean, if you think about the history of communism, all these romantic figures like Che Guevara and John Reed, none of them pulled off a caper like Frank Meyer pulled off a caper of dating the head of the government that he was trying to overthrow. It's not shocking then that there became a move to deport him from the country. And in 1934, Frank became a cause célèbre. Clement Attlee, the future prime minister, took his side on the floor of parliament. You had a petition going around with people like the philosopher Bertrand Russell and E.M. Forster, the Passage to India author, signing this petition saying we need to keep him in this country. You had Michael Strait, who later became the publisher of the New Republic. He talks about marching around London chanting "Free Frank Meyer, Free Frank Meyer." So Frank became a real cause célèbre. You know, unfortunately, all that got tossed down the memory hole when the communists erased them from their history. And what happened is by June of 1934, they deported Meyer, ostensibly for his communist activities. But I have to wonder if you're, if you're dating the prime minister's youngest daughter in 10 Downing Street, how much that played a role in them kicking him out of the country.
How did his experiences as a communist in the UK, including, as you noted, becoming a cause célèbre, how did that influence his later conservative ideas, or did it?
Well, I think two things. One, the fact that he was sort of an organizer extraordinaire who took the communist movement at Oxford from 0 to 300 students, and the Depression helped that along as well. He was able to apply that as a conservative. But I think what's more striking is what happened when he was in the American Party. When he left England, he worked for a guy named Walter Ulbricht directly on peace activism. And for some of your older listeners, they probably know Walter Ulbricht was the longest serving dictator of East Germany. He is the guy that erected the Berlin Wall. By the time that Meyer became in his orbit, he had already ordered the murders of a couple of policemen in Germany, and he was on the run from justice in Germany. So Meyer worked on peace activism, of all things, for this guy, and he was under his discipline for a number of months. He went to the United States. He didn't really become, in England, he was on the board of the Communist Party of Great Britain. You know, he was the director of the Student Bureau of the Communist Party. So he was a big deal from a very young age in England in the party. When he got to the United States, he was sort of a mid-level manager for most of his time there, until he got cozy with Earl Browder, who was the chairman of the party, was the general secretary of the party. And what he said to Browder was, listen, we are not going to bring in bowlers into our party if we continue on this sort of hardline Marxist rhetoric all the time. We've already got all the Marxists we want. We need to bring in regular Americans. And to do that, we need to fuse the Marxism with the American tradition. And we need to do this not just on the 4th of July, but every day of the year. Now, whether Browder was going to do that anyway, or whether he took Meyer's advice, he went in that direction. And what Meyer called that was a fusionism. Now, what Meyer did in the conservative movement was the same thing, basically. What he is known for is fusionism. And what that is that he looked at when he was a Marxist, he realized, I mean, he was an ideologue, but he wasn't a dumb guy. He realized that Marxism really didn't fit with the American tradition. He tried to fit a square peg in a round hole. And that led to him ultimately leaving the communist movement. And when he became a conservative, that idea stuck around. If Marxism doesn't fit into the American tradition, what does?
Yeah. And is that why fusionism didn't work on the left? Because it was, like, as you said, it's like trying to put a square peg in a round hole?
I think so. But as far as the communists were concerned, in the 1930s, of course, their big slogan was communism is 20th century Americanism. When they had the Popular Front, that's when communism had the most support from the mainstream left. That's when they had the most members. So in a sense, it did work for them. It just didn't work in the sense that they were ever going to go from an extremist fringe group to a mainstream party. In that sense, it didn't work.
Yeah. You describe Meyer as a free love enthusiast turned family man. How did his personal transformation reflect or influence his political evolution?
Well, I think that was part of it, certainly. I mean, one thing that the party tried to do in 1945 was they went to Elsie Meyer, his wife, and said, listen, Frank is slipping. He's no longer salvageable. we still think you're a good communist. We want you to divorce your husband to remain in the party. And for Elsie Meyer, that was a very scary prospect because she loved Frank Meyer. And at that point, there had been a number of reasons why they would have left, but that was sort of the straw on the camel's back, and they left. They wanted to have this family life up in Woodstock. Meyer obtained a firearm. He started to be a nocturnal creature because, as you know, the communists, you know, obviously they murdered a lot of people around the world. In the United States, that was much more rare, but it wasn't unprecedented. They had killed Americans. And so Meyer, being a witness against his former comrades, got this gun, started staying up all night. And in this farmhouse in Woodstock, you could kind of see who was coming. So his life very much changed after that point.
When David Horowitz made a very public conversion from the radical left to the right, he suffered a lot of personal and professional slings and arrows, and he continued to for the rest of his life over that conversion. Did Frank Meyer have to endure a similar onslaught?
Yes. I mean, he lost so many of his friends. I mean, one of his friends was a guy named Philip Guston, who, for people interested in art, he sold one of his paintings, or, you know, he's dead now, but one of his paintings sold a few years ago for $26 million. So Frank was around people that were sort of movers and shakers. Frank wasn't much of a supporter of Dwight Eisenhower, but Guston blamed him for his election and thought that there was going to be a fascist movement. And people like that in Woodstock, they kept their distance from Frank Meyer. He wasn't allowed sort of in their social circles. There were a few people that were tolerant enough to kind of hang out with him. One of them was a guy named Theodore Sturgeon, who, for the Trekkies in the audience, he wrote the line "Live Long and Prosper." He came up with the Prime Directive in Star Trek. He wrote a few episodes. And Frank at National Review had Sturgeon writing reviews for National Review. So there were people like that that, you know, opened up to Frank. But that for the most part, Woodstock, which was an artist colony, and obviously it became what it became in the 60s, Frank was persona non grata with a lot of these folks.
Tell us about the origins of National Review magazine. What was Meyer's role in that, and how did his work there help define the direction of American conservatism?
National Review was the idea of a guy named Willy Schlamm, who was a German emigre, also a former communist. He had met Lenin at the age of 16, and the thing he wanted more in life than anything was to run a magazine. Now, it was fate that he wouldn't do that at National Review. He came up with the idea. Bill Buckley did the heavy lifting, William F. Buckley. He raised the money for it, and he executed the plan. And Meyer's role in National Review initially was, you know, as a contributor, but Schlamm very quickly kind of washed out of National Review. Meyer took his place as the book review editor. So that back of the book that we just talked about with a guy like Theodore Sturgeon or later Gary Wills, Meyer became the first editor to publish a freelance piece by Joan Didion. So he was a great finder of talent in that role that he took over from Schlamm as the books, arts, and manners editor. He was the literary editor. But he also took over another role from Schlamm. Meyer became essentially the leader of National Review's right wing. And so he was often at polls, at odds with a guy named James Burnham. Burnham, a lot of your listeners will know. I mean, he was a Trotskyite. Trotsky rather famously said, Jim Burnham isn't stupid. He's just a snob. His friend, Dwight MacDonald, he's stupid, but Jim Burnham's not stupid. Burnham, obviously, prior to joining National Review, he was quite famous in intellectual circles. George Orwell wrote an essay about him and even credited him for part of 1984. Burnham was kind of National Review's left wing. His conservatism basically started with foreign policy, and he wasn't so much a conservative with regard to domestic policy. And so Meyer and Burnham clashed, and they had a fight over the soul of National Review. I think Meyer lost that fight within National Review, but outside of it, Meyer was victorious within the broader conservative movement. And so that's how that fight went.
What about Meyer's impact on later political giants like Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan? How did his ideas directly influence them?
Well, Meyer was an advisor to the campaign. They were giving him a per diem, and Goldwater solicited him for advice. But really what Meyer did was sort of nudge him to run, to really Goldwater, in a weird sense, I don't know that he really even wanted to run for president, but there was so much pressure upon him to run. And of course, National Review was a huge part of that. His book, A Conscience of a Conservative, of course, was written by one of Meyer's closest friends, Brent Bazell. And the folks within National Review, you know, they thought he was kind of the identikit president, that he would just make the ideal conservative. Meyer in 1960 wrote a memo to his fellow editors there and said, listen, we shouldn't under any circumstances hitch our flag to Richard Nixon. This guy's an opportunist. Let's not endorse for president in 1960. It may take us 20 years to elect one of our own. It may take us until 1980, but we'll finally elect one of our own. It's just not going to happen this year. And so he was very prophetic long term on what would happen. Short term, he often confused his wishes for reality. And so even a couple months before the 1964 election, he was talking about the possibility of Goldwater winning in a landslide. And of course, that landslide happened. It just didn't happen for Goldwater. Now, after that election, almost immediately, he shifted course and he looked upon Ronald Reagan and said, there is a star. Of course, Reagan literally was a star, but he thought this is the guy that's going to bring us to the promised land. And much of his efforts over the last 8 years of his life was to try to propel Ronald Reagan to the presidency. He would not see that. But in 1981, when Reagan spoke at CPAC, he started giving deference to a number of conservative figures. And he stopped for an extra long time, more than on any other figure, on Frank Meyer and what Frank Meyer had done to sort of lay the seeds for that moment for the election of Ronald Reagan.
Interesting, yeah. Your book highlights a number of debates and rivalries within the conservative movement that Meyer was involved in. Can you give another example of a key conflict he was involved in and how it may have helped shape conservatism?
There's too many to pick from. I think that, you know, Meyer was one of these guys that liked debate and they liked to have a fight. So one example would be Brent Bazell. Brent Bazell, prior to going to Spain, was a Meyerite. Was someone who was a National Review, Bill Buckley style conservative. He went to Spain, Franco Spain, and he wrote Meyer and said, "Listen, you have to come and live with us in Spain. The United States is no longer the country that's fit to defend the West. It's done for. Spain is the only country that can do that." And Meyer thought this was very peculiar. He said, you know, what are we going to do with National Review? We're going to have an auxiliary in Kent, Connecticut, where Jim Burnham lives, and he's going to run it from Kent. How are we going to run a magazine about America from Spain? What are we going to do about money? What are you supposed to do about my kids? Bring my kids over there? So he thought this was very odd. Bazell said, I no longer want to be president of the United States. I want to be Caudillo of Spain. And a lot of this was influenced by his Catholicism. He was a convert. And Meyer and Bazell, who were great friends at that point, became, at least philosophically, at different ends. Meyer believed in freedom. He talked about the federal government having three distinct functions, to adjudicate disputes through courts, to the police function, and to defend the country against foreign enemies. And Bazell wanted a more ambitious role for government to sort of instill virtue. And so they started arguing about this in National Review. Now, if you were to read their articles in National Review, which are probably the most classic articles to ever appear in that magazine, you would think that these guys hate each other. In reality, the letters that I found, you have Bazell writing to Meyer saying, listen, I'm going to excommunicate you from the conservative movement. We need to do this at a time when Bill Buckley's gone. If he doesn't let me do it, I may resign from the magazine. So let's, you know, when he's away in Switzerland, let's find a way to slip this in. And they're basically conspiring to put these articles in the magazine that are, you know, Bazell essentially bashing Meyer and Meyer essentially bashing Bazell. They were friends, but it wasn't always the case that the people that Meyer was debating with were friends. And a great example of that, a guy that had a little bit more sensitivities than, was a little bit more sensitive than Bazell, would be Russell Kirk.
Tell us a little bit about Russell Kirk for those conservatives who might, you know, maybe younger conservatives who don't realize the influence that Kirk had on conservatism.
Well, in the early 1950s, he wrote a book called The Conservative Mind. And it was, you know, more than anything else, was one of the reasons that you had a, you know, it brought conservatism respectability that it hadn't had for a long time because it was a very beautiful book. Meyer and a number of other people just disagreed with it, that Kirk's book was like I said, it was very beautiful, and it talked about sort of the proper attitude that a conservative might have, but it didn't do much as far as translating conservatism for a political program, and that's where they kind of differed. So Meyer in 1955, and I should say Kirk was a massive figure at this point,
yeah.
And Meyer was a smaller figure, and in 1955 he wrote a piece for the Freeman called Collectivism Rebaptized, which he essentially accused Kirk of being a collectivist, of being a socialist by another name. And at that point, you know, the letters that I came up with, Kirk, he didn't even want to be associated with National Review because of Meyer's involvement. Meyer had written this article with a guy named Frank Chodorov being the editor, encouraging him, egging him on. And I found letters from Bill Buckley indicating that he knew that this was going to happen. He knew that this hit piece on Kirk was going to occur. And Kirk didn't know this, of course, but when Buckley went to Kirk and said, you know, we want you on the masthead of our magazine, he said, how can I appear cheek by jowl with those two, meaning Frank Meyer and Frank Chodorov? And so Kirk's association with National Review from the start became kind of tentative in great degree because of Frank Meyer. Frank, it's strange, Frank with Jim Burnham, Frank had this, you know, ongoing fight with Jim Burnham. I don't think Jim Burnham went home and thought much about Frank Meyer, but Frank Meyer, I think, did obsess a bit over Jim Burnham. The roles were reversed with Kirk, where after Meyer wrote that article bashing Kirk, I don't think he thought much about Kirk. Whereas Kirk, for years, at least according to Buckley, had this unilateral obsession with Frank Meyer. It kind of waned over time, but he really despised Meyer for a good number of years.
Was Meyer's influence basically limited to kind of behind-the-scenes interactions with the movers and shakers, or did his writing have any kind of a public impact? He had a book called In Defense of Freedom, right?
So In Defense of Freedom, when it came out, it was, you know, it sold 3,000 copies, which is a very respectable number of copies, but it's not, you know, it's not a success. It's not a bestseller or anything like that.
Yeah.
After his death, Regnery Gateway put out an edition, Liberty Fund put out an edition. It's one of those books, you know, what I would liken it to is, if you ever, Brian Eno made a comment about the album, Velvet Underground, yeah, and Nico. And he said, you know, it only sold 30,000 copies, but everyone who bought a copy started a band. And I think it's the same thing with In Defense of Freedom. Pretty much everyone who read that book in the 1960s and 1970s started a conservative organization, ran for office, launched a magazine. They did something. And so the book was profoundly influential, even if its numbers, even if it was not a bestseller. I mean, if you think about a book like None Dare Call a Conspiracy, I mean, I don't know that that book was influential, but it sold a million copies or whatever it sold. So there can be books that sell a lot of copies that no one talks about years later. That's not the case with In Defense of Freedom. It was profoundly influential on the right. And it you know, its basic point was, you know, the government had these three functions that you didn't want to. Meyer was a huge fan of Tolkien. And whether you give that ring to Gandalf or Gollum or Gandhi, it doesn't matter. You don't want to have power concentrated in one hand. And I think the overall point of that book was disperse power, and that the government is not the people. They're a separate function. I think he probably got that from Albert J. Nock. So there's it had a profound effect on conservatives, and as did his column, Principles and Heresies, in National Review. He was kind of, you know, he was a bit of a commissar in the Communist Party. He was a bit of a commissar in the conservative movement. In other words, he was the chief ideologist of the post-war right. And, you know, of course, people like Buckley and readers of National Review hung on his every word. But he didn't have the, it's strange. I mean, I want to say he didn't have the popular appeal as Buckley. But obviously a guy who's messing around with the prime minister's daughter in 10 Downing Street, I mean, he loses his virginity to Dorothy Canning Miller, who was an absolutely beautiful woman who became the chief curator at the Museum of Modern Art. I think I counted like four or five different women that he was with that have Wikipedia entries. So he obviously had this charisma. When he was on the left, one of the letters I found said, you know, Frank, I love drinking with you. You know, we need to take a cook's tour of this part of the country. And I read all these books that you recommended and blah, 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 blah. It goes on about how this guy wanted to hang out with Frank Meyer. I look at the bottom. It's from James A. Michener. Meyer attracted, guys wanted to drink with him. women wanted to, you know, share and embrace. And he did have a charisma. It just wasn't a kind of public charisma that, say, a William F. Buckley had.
Yeah, I love that you, you've already kind of alluded to this a couple of times. I love how full Meyer's life was of these colorful episodes and that he seemed to know everyone and have his influential hand in everything behind the scenes. I love this quote toward the beginning of the book, which I want to read. You mentioned that Meyer, quote, navigated a labyrinth of sex, secret agents, suicide, and Satan. His close encounters in ways peripheral and profound with the giants of his age in literature, music, science, art, and politics follow that pattern of intersecting with the main players when it mattered. He knew everybody. Everybody knew his charisma. Famous women wanted and got him, and famous men wanted to become his friend, unquote. He really did have an amazing life with all these colorful episodes. Is there another anecdote about him that maybe surprised or amused you in some way that you could share?
Well, I mean, he was best friends with Eugene O'Neill Jr., and so he had a lot of close encounters with, or he had a major close encounter with Eugene O'Neill Sr. at Belgrade Lakes when he wrote the third of his four Pulitzer Prize-winning biographies, I'm sorry, plays in 1926, when, you know, the story's a little too long to get into, but Eugene O'Neill Jr. killed himself after drinking Frank Meyer's whiskey. They stayed up all night talking about suicide, reminiscing about the past. And the next day, Elsie Meyer, his wife, found his body. And if you've read a Eugene O'Neill play, you know that they can be kind of grim. Eugene O'Neill Jr. was his bleakest creation, and Meyer was his best friend. And that that suicide really shaped his life. Now, one of the quirky and weird ways it shaped him is that he later wrote In Defense of Freedom. He later wrote his Principles and Heresies columns, his book, The Molding of Communists, on the very desk that Eugene O'Neill wrote the second of his Pulitzer Prize-winning plays. So you had this sort of continuity between Eugene O'Neill and Meyer that I think is very peculiar. In the late 1960s, you know, Meyer moved to Woodstock to get away. And there was another guy that moved to Woodstock to get away. He moved in right next door to Meyer. The properties touched, and that was Bob Dylan. And so Meyer probably would have been the person in the 1960s that would have been least interested or impressed by Bob Dylan. But they met and they got along. And Meyer's response was, this guy has more, you know, he has more sense than I would have thought. He seems to have common sense. And of course, if you read Dylan's autobiography years later, the way he talks about the hippies and the drug people in the 1960s, it's far more harsh than anything that came out of Frank Meyer's typewriter. He says that I wanted to set fire to these people. So he moved next to Frank Meyer for the same reason that Meyer moved there, which is to be, you know, up on Ohio Mountain Road in Woodstock. That's pretty much away from the town. And that's why Meyer moved there, to get away from the communists, and Dylan moved there to get away from the hippies.
Another notable person that Meyer interacted with or was connected to was Rose Wilder Lane, who is not so famous herself, but she was the daughter of Laura Ingalls Wilder, who wrote Little House on the Prairie and that whole series. And Rose Wilder Lane apparently became a mentor, a conservative mentor to Meyer. Can you describe that relationship?
Rose Wilder Lane was a rather massive figure on the American right prior to World War II. And Roosevelt, you know, Russell Kirk was going to title his book The Conservative Rout. So thoroughly were conservatives defeated that he was going to title his book The Conservative Rout. And Lane was one of those right-wingers who got routed. She was a libertarian. She wasn't a conservative. And so after the war, all of those people, like Lane, Isabel Patterson, Garrett, John T. Flynn, they all diminished in importance because their world had been kind of wiped out. They didn't believe in foreign intervention, and they didn't believe in the New Deal. And obviously there was a very different world after World War II than there was before it. Lane further marginalized herself because her principals told her, don't get this Social Security number. So she never got a Social Security number, which prevented her from doing as much writing as she had prior to that. She mentored Frank Meyer. She wrote him starting in 1953, and they had a decades-long correspondence. I have, you know, probably 100,000 letters that I pulled out of that warehouse in Altoona. The best letters, the best letter writer, and like I said, you know, C.S. Lewis, Tolkien, Joan Didion, William F. Buckley, there's a lot of monster writers in this collection. the best letter writer is clearly Rose Wilder Lane. And wow. She gave Frank Meyer what he didn't have as a communist, which was a mentor. She challenged him, and Frank sort of figured out what he didn't believe. And then she also imbued in him some ideas. And one of those ideas, I think, that she reinforced in him, at least, she had this sort of red, white, and blue libertarianism, which a lot of libertarians, they don't believe in borders. They don't, you know, they're not very patriotic. Lane was very different. She was this all-American, and she thought we didn't get our, you know, that we weren't the beneficiaries of thousands of years of tradition, but instead we were the beneficiaries of an ocean that separated us from Europe. And Meyer didn't believe that, but part of what he got from her was this idea that freedom was patriotic. In other words, fusionism, Meyer's idea, was that, you know, if you're a conservative in Great Britain, you might conserve the aristocracy, the monarchy. If you're a conservative in Italy, you might conserve the Catholic Church. If you're conservative in the United States, you want to conserve the founding. And what is the meaning of founding? That's our tradition, the American founding. What is the founding's meaning? Well, its meaning is freedom. And that's where you get fusionism. And so in that sense, tethering his pro-liberty ideas to patriotism, that was something that Lane did as well. And so she had a profound influence on Meyer.
I'm jumping around a little bit here because there's so much material to work with and so many things to discuss about Frank Meyer. It's just really kind of amazing how much you've packed into this book. And let me just stop myself right there to note that this is incredibly well researched. You've got 110 pages of notes at the back of the book. How long did it take you to put this book together, and how intense a process was that for you writing this biography?
Well, it was the most intense process of any of my books. It took 6 years. I've taken longer to write a book. But, you know, the big problem with this was that when I started reading books and reading old issues of National Review, and I thought, okay, it's time for me to go into some archives. And then COVID hit, and I wasn't able to do that. And so I panicked. What could I do? And so I did a FOIA request from the federal government, and they said, well, our requests from 2014, we're processing now. They told me this in 2022, a year after I made the request. But yours are going to take a little bit longer because of COVID. So, you know, basically check back with us in the 2030s. So what was I going to do? And I essentially wished into existence this trove that I found in the warehouse. And that's really what allows this book to be so different from so many others. These are letters, for the most part, that don't appear in any other archive. You know, there's 1,000 letters between Meyer and Wilmore Kendall. You talk about a personality. We discussed Lane being the best letter writer. Her letters were very philosophical, and you'd come out of it being much more educated. With Wilmore Kendall's letters, his letters are much more gossipy. So Kendall was the teacher of Bill Buckley at Yale. He was the teacher of Brent Bazell. He's an extremely colorful character that gets lost too often today and gets forgotten. But when he's writing Meyer, he's writing a peer. He's writing a friend. And so he'll say things like, listen, I'm sorry I didn't get that book review in, but remember that 19-year-old co-ed I told you about? She showed up at my door again. And this time I didn't, you know, I let her in. And so he is, you know, he's my age. He's a 50-year-old guy. He's talking about having, you know, messing around with, you know, 20-year-old college students, 19-year-old college students. There's a letter in which he says, you know, I'm kind of on a health kick, to Meyer. I normally smoke 70 cigarettes a day, but now I'm down to a pack, which is, you know, 20 cigarettes a day. In other words, these were like Mad Men. If you watch the show Mad Men, a lot of these guys lived Mad Men existences. And yeah. And Wilmore Kendall, more than any of those post-war conservatives, led a madman existence. I think nowadays you'd probably say the guy had a personality disorder, but he was so colorful. And his letters are so amazingly colorful. And I'm grateful to have found these 1,000 letters because a lot of them really give color to my book.
Yes, they certainly do. Again, I'm jumping around a little bit, but I wanted to make sure I asked you about Frank Meyer and the Cold War, because you noted in your book that, in fact, I'm just going to read here, more than 35 years before the fall of the Iron Curtain, Meyer's objective was the overthrow of the Kremlin. So he was kind of ahead of his time. But can you talk a little bit about Meyer's perspective on the Cold War?
Sure. I mean, Meyer saw communism from inside the belly of the beast. The guy he mentored to be his replacement as the leader of the young communists in Great Britain was a guy named John Cornford, who was Charles Darwin's great-grandson. He died a day after his 21st birthday fighting in the Spanish Civil War. The guy who led Meyer to the Communist Party of Great Britain's headquarters in London was named Prince Mirsky. He died in a gulag later that decade. So Frank had friends that died, and then he had friends like, or not friends, a guy who worked for Walter Ulbricht, who killed people. He knew the murderous nature of communism, and he got out and he fought it knowing its identity. And so you mentioned him being somewhat prophetic. I mean, in 1962, he went around the country saying, "Mr. Khrushchev, tear down this wall." That's 25 years before Ronald Reagan essentially said the same thing to Mr. Gorbachev. Obviously, Reagan's had much more of an effect. But Meyer was very prophetic in that sense. His anti-communism was so, you know, he talked about the possibility of doing a preemptive strike on the Soviet Union. When Sputnik happened, he thought these people were such liars that they probably made up Sputnik. So he wasn't always right about what he thought, but he sent a number of communists to jail. He testified and named names, dozens and dozens of communists. And so by the mid-1950s, even by the early 1950s, the Communist Party of the United States is profoundly disrupted in large part because of Frank Meyer. And Frank was a witness. Louis Budenz was a witness. Elizabeth Bentley, Whitaker Chambers, they all played a big role. But they're really, the Communist Party domestically didn't have much of effect. Frank kind of knew that by the mid-50s. And so he shifted his attention to the Soviet Union, that it was a foreign policy where communism to him was an issue. Whereas if you look at, you know, say like the John Birch Society, they were obsessed with domestic communists. Frank understood that those people, at least by the mid-1950s, they really held very little power in this country. So his focus was what was going on outside of the U.S. borders, because he felt that there was an existential threat. I mean, think about it today. Putin invades one country, Ukraine, and he possesses, I don't know, 20% of Ukraine. During World War II, Stalin took over, what was it, about a dozen countries in Europe? And a lot of people, the same type of people who you know, get all up in a lather about Putin now, just kind of poo-pooed the idea that Stalin was doing anything that evil and wrong when he took over 12 countries. And then they took over more and more after that. And so Frank realized what was going on and he thought, well, gee, you know, this could happen to us. I better fight it.
Well, tell us a little bit about Frank's wife, Elsie, because she's kind of an interesting character in her own right. What is her, what was her influence on Frank, and what became of her after he passed away?
Well, she was profoundly influential on him. I mean, they had a very tight bond. They loved each other. They met, obviously, in the Communist Party. He was a he was the director of the Chicago Worker School, and she was a student there. And she thought, this guy will never pay any attention to me. And lo and behold, you know, Frank was paying attention to her. Elsie had been involved in the Flint sit-down strike. She was a communist activist at Radcliffe College. And, you know, later went on to more activism. They were kind of in the party, they were a bit of a team, but they also were a bit of a team at National Review, in the sense that Frank, titular editor of the literary section of Books, Arts, and Manners, he would pick out the books, he would pick out the reviewers. Elsie pretty much would do the actual reviewing. They also had a very, they were a team in the sense that, you know, they had two kids, and they thought these were the greatest fruits of their union. And they thought, we can't entrust this to the state. And so far earlier than you know, most other people started homeschooling in, say, the 1980s and 1990s, the Meyers homeschooled. And this was a very odd thing at the time. So they're both the teachers at the school. And at one point you had kind of a social worker show up at the house and say, where are the kids? They're not in school. And they said, well, you know, we're homeschooling them. He said, you didn't get our permission to do this. And Meyer yells out from the bedroom, I don't need your permission to do anything with my kids. You need my permission to do anything with my children. And so he was very, on education, I think more than anything, he was very passionate about. Elsie, like I said, she was sort of an editor with him, a team editor for National Review for something called The Exchange, which was kind of an early conservative message board where they would place conservatives in jobs in academia. And she was quite dependent on Frank, and Frank was quite dependent on her. So when he died of lung cancer in 1972, she kind of spiraled, and her life, Buckley paid her more than she paid her husband. So I think he thought she was doing, he was doing her a good deed, but she was quite insulted. She was initially the acting editor of the book section that Frank had been an editor of. And very quickly they had hired George Will. And so she did that for about a year. He took her place. And after that, her job essentially, at least in her eyes, was as a copy editor, which I can tell you a copy editor is a very important role as a writer. They've saved me from so many editors, from so many errors. But Elsie found that as kind of an insult, that she was just sort of, she had a grand title, but she was sort of a glorified copy editor. And her, in 1975, just, you know, a few hundred yards from where she found Eugene O'Neill Jr.'s body, she decided to take her own life as well, outside of their house in Woodstock. And I, you know, that's why I said before that Eugene, you know, this interaction with Eugene O'Neill and with Eugene O'Neill Jr., it had profound influence on Frank and Elsie Meyer. When he was dying of cancer, you know, there's some evidence that he had obtained cyanide to perhaps, you know, exit this world prior to cancer kind of taking him. Now, he had such heavy, you know, the cancer was going to take him. So at that point, it was kind of silly. And that was one of the reasons why he struggled with joining the Catholic Church, because why join a church that had condemned your best friend to hell in Eugene O'Neill Jr.? That's, you know, Eugene O'Neill Jr. slit his wrists. He slit his ankle. He went out in Seneca style because he was a classicist. That's what he taught. He was an expert on Greek, and he taught, you know, in these classics department at Yale and Princeton. And so Frank struggled with that. And ultimately he joins the Catholic Church and dies of cancer. A few years later, Elsie just couldn't bear to live. And she took the weapon that Frank presumably had bought to protect him from the communists. And she used that on herself.
Dan, for readers who are new to Meyer or the history of conservatism, what's a takeaway that you hope they gain from your book, The Man Who Invented Conservatism?
Well, I think for a lot of people, Frank's personality, he might have evoked a lit cigarette, or he might have evoked the telephone because he was constantly calling people from Woodstock. But what Meyer really meant was freedom. And if you read In Defense of Freedom, you get that impression. If you read his columns, Principles and Heresies in National Review, you get that impression. So to the extent that the post-war conservative right took on a freedom liberty hue, Frank Meyer was a big reason for that. It didn't need to go that way. I mean, Russell Kirk's book was taking it in a very different direction. And there were other people like Wilmore Kendall or Brent Bazell that would have taken the right in a different direction. But fusionism, his ideas, they essentially became the default philosophy of the post-war American right. Frank became so influential that even people that had never heard the name Frank Meyer had been influenced by him. Even people who had never heard the word fusionism became fusionists. Certainly the Reagan presidency was the embodiment of Frank Meyer's dreams. It was really a fusionist presidency. And fusionism from Goldwater, certainly well through Reagan, became the default philosophy of the American right. Now, obviously right now, it does not have the sway that it once did. But I think you can still see Frank's, you see his fingerprints on all sorts of stuff. I mean, there'd be issues where he would disagree with Donald Trump. But there were other issues where he was, I think, of profound influence on the current right today.
Well, it's an amazing book. It's an amazing story. And I'm so glad you had the persistence to hunt down those that treasure trove of documents we talked about earlier. Dan, how can people keep up online with what you are doing?
Well, I write for the American Spectator, so spectator.org. I currently write a newsletter called Spectator AM that's sort of subscription-based, and it's a lot of fun. We have, I don't know, there's thousands and thousands of readers that are reading that every day and having a blast. And of course, obviously, there's the book. I'm not on Twitter. I'm not on social media. Maybe I should get on there. But I found it very difficult. You know, I wrote this book, The Man Who Invented Conservatism. The idea of writing a book and keeping up with a Twitter handle, boy, to me, that would be very difficult. So I chose to write the book, but, you know, I live in 2025. I don't live in 1955. So maybe I ought to get Twitter. Maybe I ought to start doing some of that stuff.
I don't know. I think you made the right choice.
And you have a podcast, and you're telling me I made the right choice.
Oh, yeah, well, it's It's a double-edged sword having a podcast or being involved on social media for someone who's trying to get some actual writing done. Listeners, I strongly encourage you to get The Man Who Invented Conservatism. It's an enlightening deep dive into the life of an unsung hero of the conservative movement. Daniel Flynn, thanks for writing it, and thanks for joining us at The Right Take.
Mark, thank you so much.
Keep up the great work, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you.